Even if the work you're doing doesn't feel like it has momentum behind it today, or maybe it really does feel like, you know, you're moving forward and feeling more connected. I mean, these are the spaces, this is the time to be, you know, coming together with each other, you know, and really feeling into the larger fields of action. So I wanted to just leave it there and hand it off to Kristen to take us forward, but just to say again, really how wonderful it is to be here with you and to have so many of you here with us, and looking forward to what unfolds today. Kristen.
Great. Well, thank you, Lou. Again, I just want to add my welcome to that. We're so glad that you could join us today. We're here in hip deep in snow. In Washington, D.C., you may have seen on the news, the Northeast has gotten quite pummeled by yet another record-breaking snowstorm. And so this is part of the times we're living in, part of the phenomena that gathers us in some ways. And our hearts go out to all those adversely affected by the snow. I doubt if anyone who's you know, without power is able to join us today. But if you are, maybe perhaps by phone, well, special blessings to you. And of course, all those who have suffered any kind of loss, we want to connect to and honor that. But the sun is out here, and as the digging out continues, I am so grateful to this community supporting each other in authentic relationship. To these phenomena, to really this mysterious and precious life just as it is. So I also want to thank you for joining us today in this platform. And just a reminder to everybody to please don't unmute yourself. Everybody is muted, and I haven't figured out how to kind of keep that state. So you do have the power to unmute yourself, apparently. Which means that we'll get background noise, like I can hear right now. I think there might be some background noise coming from someplace. So please do keep your microphone off. Don't turn it back on. And when we go into breakout sessions or Q&A, I'll be able to turn it on for you so that you'll be able to be heard. And then a couple of other things you might notice. If you're joining us by phone, just by phone, you'll be fine for most of the session, but you won't be able to raise your hand, as it were, when we come to the Q&A session. So if you have the possibility of joining over a computer or even a smartphone, that's something that you might want to go ahead and get going in the background while you stay on that audio. But if you're just on the phone connection, you will be fine for you know, the just participating via that. That audio. And then to say that those of us who are on the computer, maybe a Mac or a PC, you might have the option, if you kind of mouse around a little bit, you'll see a button up in the corner that says gallery view or speaker view. And so you can click that and see which one you prefer. If you click on gallery view, you're going to see all three of us together. But while David's talking, for instance, you might just want to be on speaker view so that you can just see David's face and Lou and I won't be distracting you. Okay, so finally, I'll just say that when we go into the breakout sessions, that's going to be new for me. So it might take me a few seconds, maybe 30 seconds, a minute to get us into the breakout sessions in a way that really works. So I hope that you know, we'll all have patience with technology, and maybe in particular a little patience with me as I figure this out. Okay, so with that, I would like to introduce David. David Loy has been really a pioneer in this space. He and John Stanley, several years ago, created a book that really put the Dharma, really explicitly connected the Dharma to the global ecological crises. Of course, he stands on the shoulders of many who have come, many great Buddhist thinkers and ecological thinkers who have come before in various forms, but there really was this call that I heard coming from David to say, you know, this is an important issue for the Dharma, and the Dharma can speak deeply to these issues, not just climate change, species loss, the treatment of animals, all these ecological, our earth relationship, our understanding of ourselves in participation with the earth and with each other. I heard David's call loud and strong for myself. So I really am so deeply honored, David, to have you with us today and speaking to this issue, continuing to challenge both Buddhism, to challenge the predominant views of our relationship to the earth, and to challenge our practice is just such a gift, really. So I'm so glad to have you, David, and I'm so looking forward to what you have to share. After David speaks, we'll have time for the breakout sessions. We'll be offering an inquiry based on what David has offered, and then do a harvest / Q&A, and then wrap up here today. So with that, I'll hand it over to David. Again, thank you, David, for joining us. Oh, wait, hang on a second. This is where I come in. This is where I have to unmute you. Sorry, David. One second, there you are. Okay, I think you're on.
Okay, can you hear me okay? Technologically, yes. Are we all right? Great,
yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, thank you, Kristen and Lou. I'm really delighted to be back with One Earth Sangha, and especially to be talking about this really, I think, interesting and important issue, which is whether and in what ways the ecological crisis might also be a crisis for our ways of understanding Buddhism. And practicing Buddhism. And the way that I'd like to approach it is by talking about two icebergs, not real icebergs. These don't have anything to do with what's going on in the Arctic, but metaphorical ones, taking advantage of the fact that icebergs, as we know, only about 1/5 of it is visible above the surface of the sea. The other 4/5 is down below, largely invisible, but of course supporting the part that we do see. And the first iceberg that I want to talk a little bit about is basically our situation, not just our ecological situation, but really our whole situation today. At the very top, then, at the very point, is the challenge of climate change or global warming. Both of those, I think, kind of unfortunate euphemisms for something that might be better described as ecological breakdown or climate emergency. I think something like climate or global warming might seem kind of cuddly and attractive for a lot of people right at the moment. Anyway, regarding this, I don't want to say very much except to mention very briefly three things that I think we already know. First of all, that climate change or ecological breakdown does seem to be the greatest challenge that humanity has ever faced. Secondly, that it's not an external threat. It's something that we're doing to ourselves, as Pogo said about the Vietnam War. We've met the enemy, and it is us. Imagine how differently we might be responding if some alien species came down in a spaceship and started pumping carbon into our atmosphere. How quickly we would bond together to react against that. But of course, the problem, one of the fundamental problems, is we're doing it to ourselves. And that makes it hard to figure out what to do. The third point, briefly, of course, is that a lot is happening that we are responding to. You know, as a species, as a globalizing civilization, we are responding to this challenge. Paris last month is only the most recent example of that. But I think it's also fair to say pretty clear that we're not doing enough. We're not responding sufficiently. And the question is, why not? Yet that's the very tip of the iceberg. But the overwhelming sort of emergency or challenge of climate breakdown can divert us from realizing that global warming is just one part of a much larger ecological crisis. One way to consider this is to look at what's happening to the oceans. Yes, increasing carbon in the atmosphere is being absorbed. The oceans are becoming warmer, becoming more acidified. This is affecting things like coral reefs, where most marine species live, and it's damaging phytoplankton and mollusks at the sort of bottom of the food chain. But that's by no means everything that's going on with the oceans. For example, plastic. I read recently about a study where some scientists had gone and looked at the bottom of the ocean in some very remote places, and they discovered that every square meter that they looked at had some plastic particles in it, which are often, of course, being ingested by marine life. In the center of the Pacific, and I believe the other major oceans as well, there's these great garbage patches, right? The Great Pacific Garbage Patch. And I think it was just 1 or 2 days ago, I read how by the year, well, there's two facts here. First of all, by the year 2048, it's been predicted that basically all the major fishing areas will be fished out. So that after that point, the vast majority of the fish that we'll be eating will have to be sort of grown in ponds or whatever, commercially grown. That's one fact. And then just a couple days ago, coming across this fact, by the year 2050, and again, neither of these is all that far away from now, really, if you think about it. By the year 2050, there will be more plastic in the oceans than fish or than marine life, which is a pretty staggering thought. I mean, we can go on and talk about the role of plastic and other issues in the oceans, but again, there's a lot more to the ecological crisis than just what's going on in the ocean. In particular, and maybe this is the most, shocking, provocative issue of all, is the fact that we're now in the middle of one of the Earth's great extinction events. E.O. Wilson, the renowned Harvard biologist, has predicted that, you know, by the end of this century, 50% of all plant and animal species on Earth could go extinct or be so weakened that they'll go extinct very soon after that, which is a pretty shocking figure. Again, in this case, an extinction event due to one particular species, that is to say us. Biologists tell us that there have been 5 other major extinction events in the Earth's history, but this one is apparently the fastest ever. Anyway, again, we can go on and on. You can add your own concerns, your own particular data to this. There's so many other things going on. As part of the extinction event, what's happening with monarch butterflies, which have been literally decimated? What's happening with honeybees? The fact that honeybee colonies are being disappearing, being destroyed so quickly, I mean, that means a lot more than just honey is more expensive, given the role of honeybees in fertilizing so many of the Earth's food crops. Lester Brown has spent a lot of time warning us about what's happening to aquifers, how many of the Earth's agricultural regions are turning into deserts. I've read that about 50% of the world's tropical rainforests have been destroyed in the last few generations. Think about the impact of nuclear waste, millions of tons of nuclear waste, which will be dangerously radioactive for, in many cases, tens or hundreds of thousands of years, et cetera, et cetera. We can go on and go on indefinitely here, but I think you get the point. If climate breakdown is the very tip of the iceberg. This larger ecological crisis is bigger and sort of larger than climate change. But both of those are still, we could say, above the surface. They're both what we can see. They're both visible. The question is, what do those imply about what's below the surface? Of course, we can't stop focusing on climate change, upon carbon, because of these other issues. But nonetheless, it's important to realize that it's possible that, and let's hope it happens, it's possible that we will be able to solve the problem of global warming and shift completely to renewable sources of energy. But that in and of itself is not going to solve the larger ecological crisis. I think we need to keep that in mind. That's because it seems to me this ecological crisis, the entire visible part of the iceberg, is really a symptom of something much bigger, a much bigger issue below the surface. You could say it's the predicament of a now global civilization that I think has really lost its way. Joanna Macy has talked a lot about this, of course, and many other people, but we need to keep this in mind. I mean, one way to say it is that our collective preoccupation with never-ending economic growth and consumerism, not just preoccupation, we could say it's our obsession or even our religion. Our preoccupation with ever-increasing economic growth and consumerism. The fundamental issue, of course, is that this major meaning of collective civilization, that's what really what it is. You could almost call it like our religion, if you observe what we actually do. This fundamental reorientation of our civilization, which is not going to be easy to change, needless to say, that this is really incompatible with the very finite planet that, of course, we live upon. Now, from a Buddhist perspective, a lot of things could be said about this, about why this fixation on growth can't give us the kind of satisfaction or happiness that we seek from it. But to understand better the relationship between the visible, the top path, the ecological crisis, and this larger civilizational predicament, I'd like to unpack a little bit one particular example. One particularly revealing example of overfishing, going back to the oceans, and what the Mitsubishi conglomerate is doing with bluefin tuna. As you may know, Japanese people love sashimi, raw fish, and their favorite by far is bluefin tuna. But unfortunately, bluefin tuna is commercially very endangered, which means that the fish that are caught now tend to be smaller, immature. However, Mitsubishi Corporation has come up with a rather ingenious response to this. They have basically cornered about half of the world market by buying up as many bluefin tuna as they can, many of them illegal because they exceed the limits that have been agreed to. They buy up a lot of these bluefin tuna and they import them into Japan and freeze them in their massive freezers at minus 60 degrees. Because, of course, these frozen tuna will command astronomical prices if, as predicted, bluefin tuna soon become commercially extinct or almost extinct due to overfishing by tuna fleets, which are what? They're trying to satisfy the demand of corporations like Mitsubishi. Please think for a moment what that means. From an ecological standpoint, I think it's immoral, obscene. And yet from a narrow economic perspective, I think it's quite logical, even rational. Because of course, the fewer bluefin tuna there are in the ocean, the more valuable the tuna it will be in their lockers. I mean, they can really command astronomical prices, as I mentioned. And it's the nature of economic competition, of course, that sometimes corporations like Mitsubishi are encouraged or even forced to do things like that. Because if you don't do it, well, somebody else probably will. That's how the tragedy of the commons tends to play out on the global scale. I think this example of Mitsubishi is an extreme one, but it's not an unusual one, in the sense that it points to what I would argue is a fundamental perversity sort of built into economic systems. Any economic system motivated by profit insofar as it tends to use the natural world as a means to that goal of maximizing profit, making money. Again, that's a kind of relationship that we tend to take for granted, but it becomes quite questionable, or even more than that, it becomes kind of ironic if you look at it in this way. If we remember that money in and of itself is worthless, what I mean by that is that those pieces of paper in your pocket, those numbers in your bank account, in and of themselves, they have no value whatsoever. The reason they're valuable, of course, is that we can use them as a medium of exchange to buy almost anything that we want. In other words, money is a socially agreed symbol valuable because it is our means of exchange, and we can use it to acquire almost anything that we may desire. And since I think we tend to, in a kind of unreflective way, think that the satisfaction of our desires is going to amount or give us happiness, money maybe inevitably comes to symbolize the possibility of happiness. And I think there's some of this deep meaning going on in our culture as a whole. The problem being, ecologically, of course, is that this symbolic possibility, money as leading to happiness, can often overshadow our appreciation of the natural world, which means, and here's the irony, that we sometimes or often become preoccupied with destroying real wealth. And by real wealth, I mean oceans teeming with marine life, or healthy forests, not just tree farms, but healthy forests full of life, healthy topsoil, etc. This is the real wealth of the biosphere, right? That we often end up destroying this real wealth in order to maximize the numbers in our bank accounts. Or to put it even more precisely, we end up sacrificing everything that is of real value in order to maximize something that in and of itself has no value whatsoever. Please think for a moment what that means, the irony, the kind of tragedy of that. We end up sacrificing everything really valuable for something that in and of itself has no value whatsoever. I think that helps us understand. It helps us point to why the whole ecological crisis is really just the most urgent symptom of a larger emergency, the predicament of a civilization whose foremost preoccupation, I think, is really incompatible with Buddhist values. I think this kind of perverse logic implies that sooner or later, the collective focus on endless growth, on ever-increasing production and consumption, which requires ever more exploitation of our natural resources, how sooner or later this is going to have to bump up against the limits of the biosphere. And it just so happens that it's happening now. Many Buddhist teachings are relevant here, especially I think the emphasis on interdependence and non-duality, right? We often dualize between ourselves and other people. And an important part of that is that my well-being is separate from your or that other person's. And it's something that we do not just individually, but also collectively. Our well-being is different from theirs. Curiously, one of the really interesting things about the ecological crisis is that it tends to sort of explode that. That doesn't really work. In fact, even the whole nation state system, as it's now organized, really is challenged by what the ecological crisis is showing us. Because if you think about it, when China burns coal in its coal plants, that carbon and that coal pollution, it doesn't just stay above Chinese skies, does it? The winds blow it around. When Japan, for example, has a nuclear disaster at Fukushima, the radiation that's being released into the sea, it's not just staying in Japanese coastal waters, it's spreading around the world. In other words, the ecological crisis is really something that challenges our whole way of understanding the way the world is organized. It seems to be requiring us to realize our non-duality, our interdependence. And you can make the same point generally, more generally, about our situation with the largest duality of all, the duality between humanity and the earth. You could say that we have been distinguishing the best interest, the well-being of humanity, from what is best for the well-being of the ecosystems of the earth, and basically the ecological crisis is saying, hey, that isn't going to work anymore. That's the challenge that we're into now. In fact, if you think about it, it's kind of the best example of karma that I can imagine. When the earth gets sick, the truth is we're going to get sick. When the ecosystems collapse, break down, dot, dot, dot. In short, I think the ecological crisis really seems to be a spiritual crisis as well, in the sense that we are being challenged to realize our interdependence, what you might even call kind of a larger spiritual unity, as if the earth is telling us to wake up or get out of the way. Anyway, that's enough on the first iceberg. Let's turn to the second iceberg. And what is that second iceberg? Buddhism, I think. Because the ecological crisis and the larger civilizational crisis or predicament is also just as much, I think, a crisis for the Buddhist tradition. It actually prompts us, requires us to clarify the essential message of the Buddhist tradition if it's going to fulfill its liberated potential in the modern world. In other words, I think Buddhism itself has to wake up, which is ironic given the meaning of Buddhism, literally, wake up, ism. And I want to spend the rest of my time talking about why that is so. Again, another iceberg, and at the very tip of that is Ecodharma, which is what brings us all here today. And I feel very gratified and encouraged that in the last few years, Buddhist interest in Ecodharma has really been growing exponentially. But here's my question. The ecological crisis has been front page news now for almost 25 years since the Rio Summit, I think back in 1992. Why has it taken Buddhists so long to catch up with this? Speaking personally, you know, I've been offering workshops on Ecodharma and larger social issues for probably a decade now, if not more actually. And it's interesting reflecting back how many of those had to be canceled, the scheduled ones, or should have been canceled because so few people signed up, as if there was indifference or even kind of resistance to wanting to explore the implications, to look into that. And this isn't just me. Even now, what I hear from other Buddhist teachers is that when the teacher announces that he or she is going to give a talk on Buddhism and ecology the next week, what almost always happens is quite a few fewer people actually attend. What's going on there? Why is that? Again, Ecodharma as just the tip of a larger issue, which I think we can call social engagement in general. I think it's important here that right on the time of the Great Recession 2008, the two major socially engaged organizations of Buddhists in the United States, Buddhist Peace Fellowship based in Berkeley and Zen Peacemakers in Massachusetts, both of them basically collapsed financially. I mean, they still sort of struggle on, and I think they're doing very well in many ways, given the kind of much more limited financial resources. But what's going on here? Why are they struggling? And whereas, again, without criticizing Spirit Rock in any way, I'm really impressed. Spirit Rock is growing. It gets millions and millions and millions of dollars for expansion, but the money isn't there for social engagement. Again, why not? What's going on? This doesn't mean that socially engaged Buddhism has really failed completely. In some ways, I think it's kind of been the victim of its own success, in the sense that it's now, I think, generally accepted that it can be a part of one's path to become involved helping homeless people, or hospice work, or prison dharma. In other words, I think we Buddhists have become quite a bit better at sort of pulling drowning people out of the river. But here's the challenge. We're not much better at all in asking, well, wait a minute, why are there so many more people drowning in the river these days? Who or what is pushing them in upstream? I mean, I still remain flabbergasted that in the United States, the wealthiest society in the history of humanity, we have over 1 million school children attending school who are homeless. And of course, we're now reading more and more information about the incredible growing gap between rich and poor since the Great Recession. 1%, the percentage of the Earth's wealth that they own. Just this week, I think it came out, the 1% now own more than the 99 other percent, in, not just in the United States, but taking the world as a whole. In fact, what did I read? 62 individuals are wealthier than the bottom half of humanity. What, that's well over what, close to 4 billion people or 3.8 billion people, something like that. I'm reminded of a famous line by the Brazilian bishop, Dom Helder Camara, who said, when I give food to the poor, they call me a saint. When I ask why there are so many poor, why the poor have no food, they call me a communist. I wonder if there's a Buddhist version of that. When Buddhists help homeless people and prison inmates, they're called bodhisattvas. But when we want to ask why there are so many more homeless people, so many people rotting in prison, some Buddhists say, well, no, that has nothing to do with Buddhism. That's leftism or your radicalism. That has nothing to do with Buddhism. Really? Both these forms of social engagement are very much at the top of the Buddhist iceberg. Below that, of course, is something that's become much more popular, much more influential just in the last decade. And I refer, of course, again, I want to contrast social engagement with mindfulness, the mindfulness movement, which for the most part, I think has been something very positive, very important, even wonderful, which is not to say that it isn't controversial in some ways, especially in relationship to business and corporations. I don't want to go into this in detail, except to point out that although mindfulness practices can be very beneficial, they can also, in effect, discourage critical reflection on the institutional causes of collective suffering, or what I like to call social dukkha. As Bhikkhu Bodhi has warned, quote, absent a sharp social critique, Buddhist practices could easily be used to justify and stabilize the status quo, becoming a reinforcement of consumer capitalism. In other words, Buddhist teachings could be used, and Buddhist-derived teachings like mindfulness could be used to support what I've called the submerged part of the first iceberg, this civilizational preoccupation with never-ending economic growth and consumption. And I think that's really important, that we don't consciously or unconsciously end up supporting that, but rather we're asking, what do Buddhist teachings imply about this fundamental orientation, right? The contrast, again, notice the contrast, explosively successful, the mindfulness movement, social engagement, much smaller, kind of staggering on or doing the best it can. It's the contrast between these two that I think makes us ask the questions, what is there below the surface here? Everything that I've been saying about the Buddhist iceberg is quite visible. What is there within the Buddhist tradition that maybe is encouraging this way of understanding Buddhism and practicing Buddhism? And I think examining the submerged part of the iceberg will help us understand that. So let me go into that briefly. Recently I was reading a book by an academic named Loyal Ru, and I came across something he wrote, a passage that literally stopped me in my tracks because it crystallized, it expressed so well an issue, a problem with Buddhism, or at least certain types of Buddhism, or I guess I should call it a kind of fundamental dis-ease that had been growing in me, bothering me for some time. According to Ru, religions such as Christianity and Buddhism, quote, will continue to decline as it becomes ever more apparent, he says, that they don't have what is needed to address the great challenges facing us today. In particular, he cited two basic problems, which are actually, I think, two sides of the same problem. Cosmological dualism, don't worry, I'll explain it, and individual salvation. Both of which, he says, quote, have encouraged an attitude of indifference toward natural and social systems. Cosmological dualism, in other words, the idea that there's two realities, right? There's this lower reality, but there's a higher reality for Christianity, God, heaven. And the other thing that goes along with it, of course, is that there's inevitably, in the distinction, there's a kind of a devaluation to some degree of this reality. In fact, you could say often this reality becomes kind of a means to the ends of attaining heaven so that we can, say, live eternally in the presence of God. But do we have something like this in Buddhism? Well, certainly in certain types of Buddhism, especially in early Buddhism, what's the attitude towards samsara, right? Isn't there a kind of devaluation of this world, of suffering, of craving, of delusion, and the idea that we need to transcend it or in some way escape it? There's a lot of issues about the nature of nibbana or nirvana, whether it's another reality, another dimension of reality, but it's often been understood that way, and it's been understood in a way that tends to devalue our life in this world. And in both cases, this emphasis on individual salvation, right? So for the Christian, you live a good life, God will judge you when you die, and you can go to heaven, but also in Buddhism too, there's very much the idea of awakening is an individual and the attainment of nirvana, the transcendence of this world happens when we're not reborn. And therefore, we don't have to come back to this world of suffering. Now, within the Buddhist tradition, it's a lot more complicated, right? A lot more complicated because there's things we can point to. Nagarjuna, who makes this important point that the place that samsara is not really different from the place of nirvana. So again, it's complicated. I don't want to say that this is a good description of everything Buddhism is talking about, but it is one very strong tendency that I think tends to end up devaluing this kind of world. A big issue today, of course, is that modern science, while in many ways compatible with Buddhism, right? Emphasis interdependence ecologically and Shunyata emptiness, modern physics, and so forth, but it really hasn't discovered anything that seems to support or encourage some kind of higher reality. And the whole tendency of the modern secular world is to deny that. And so I think it's not surprising that there is, I think, a response to that and a much more this-worldly understanding of the path in modern, especially Western Buddhism. That is to say, understanding the Buddhist path as a program of psychological development that helps us cope with our personal problems, especially our monkey mind and afflictive emotions, which of course has led to some very important and exciting sort of innovative developments in psychotherapy. So Buddhism, I think, is providing new perspectives on psychological well-being and new practices to reduce greed, ill will, and hatred right now. Pre-dual delusion right now, and also helping us sort through our emotional lives, which are not, that's not a big issue in Asian Buddhism for the most part, working through our personal traumas. So you can say the basic presupposition of this more secular type of Buddhism is that the core problem is the way my mind works, and the solution is simply to change my mind so that, to change the way my mind works, so that what? So that I fit into my roles better. So I'm a better spouse, so I'm a better father, so I'm a better worker, a better friend, so that my life goes more smoothly, right? But notice the pattern here. A lot of traditional aids in Buddhism emphasizes ending rebirth into this unsatisfactory world. The idea is to transcend it, in some way to escape it. In contrast, a lot of modern Buddhism, especially things like modern psychotherapy and Buddhist-derived practices like mindfulness, they're much more about harmonizing with this world. Please note, neither one of these, although they're opposites in one way, neither one of these is concerned about transforming this world or addressing it's institutional, it's larger problems. Both tend to take this world for granted, and in that sense tend to accept it as it is, right? Asian Buddhism lets escape the world, samsara cannot be changed. For much of contemporary Buddhism, the path is all about changing myself, because it's not the society that's the problem, it's not the world that's the problem, it's just me, it's my own mind, and if I change my own mind, then everything is going to be okay. Neither of these approaches encourages eco-dharma. That's my fundamental point here. Or other types of social engagement. Say it again. Whether you understand the path as somehow transcending this world, or somehow understanding the path as changing your mind so you fit into the world better, neither one of those encourages us to actually look for what might be called the causes of social dukkha, the institutionalization of greed, ill will, delusion in the way that society is actually working, and of course is very much relevant to our ecological situation. In fact, I think that both of these main ways of understanding Buddhism, whether it's escaping this world or fitting into it, I think both of them actually end up promoting a distinctively Buddhist type of way of resolving the ecological crisis or responding to it. By which I mean this. When I read something disturbing ecologically, for example, when I read that, as we just learned, 2015 was the warmest year in recorded history after 2014, which had been the warmest. When I read these kinds of things, and they seem to come pretty fast and furious, what happens? Well, of course, I feel somewhat distraught, concerned, often discouraged, maybe even depressed, anxious. But hey, I'm a Buddhist practitioner, right? I know what to do when I feel anxious. I know how to cope with that. I take out my zafu, my cushion, and I sit down, face the wall, meditate for an hour. And what happens? Well, I were able to let go of that anxiety. I'm able to let go of those concerns. The problem is, as it were, over for me for a while. In a way, that is a kind of response to the ecological crisis. Needless to say, it's not a very satisfactory one, and yet I think it's one that, if we're honest, is not all that uncommon in the way that Buddhism is being practiced in this country. So my basic point here is that this ambivalence about the nature of awakening is a challenge that we really need to resolve. We can't simply accept this anymore. It's not just a matter of saying we're meditating in order to kind of check out from this world. We don't want to be bothered by all these problems. Or we're meditating in order to sort of resolve our mind, resolve whatever psychological problems we have so that we can somehow harmonize more with the world. I think we do need to clarify what the essential message of Buddhism is, and I think, in fact, it's really neither one of those. I think neither one of those honors what I think the best of the tradition has to offer us here. My suggestion, although there's not really time to go into it here in detail, is that is another way of understanding the Buddhist path, that the Buddhist path is really not about escaping the world or harmonizing with it. It's rather about deconstructing and reconstructing how we experience the world, and in particular, how we experience ourselves in relation to the world. In other words, we experience the world in the way that we do because of the ways our minds work, and that we can actually transform our minds so that we experience the world in a different way. But it's not just our minds, it's actually the way the world is experienced. Basically, what I'm getting at here is I think the fundamental dukkha of Buddhism is very much connected with the sense of separate self, the sense of duality, that somehow I'm in here and the rest of the world is out here. We resolve this dukkha by deconstructing the sense of self. That's what's going on when we're meditating. And also reconstructing, and that's what's going on with transforming our motivations, which of course is really, I think, the key of what the Buddha was talking about when he talked about karma. I think somehow we've got karma wrong. We've missed the point that the Buddha was emphasizing motivations, intentions. It's by changing our motivations that we actually come to experience the world in a different way. And we don't need to worry about the consequences. What we need to be concerned about is our motivations right here and now, how we respond to the situations that we're in, including not just personal individual ones, but larger social challenges such as our ecological crisis. And to conclude, please notice the really important social implication. If what I'm saying is true, if this is a better way to understand that we individually can deconstruct and reconstruct our way of relating, our way of experiencing and relating to the world, this also applies to our social reality, to our social situation, including eco-dharma. As we start to wake up and realize that we're not separate from each other, nor from this wonderful earth, we can also begin to realize that the ways we live together, the ways that we relate to Mother Earth, these too also need to be reconstructed. Which means not only social engagement understood as service, helping people individually, but finding ways to address the problematical economic and political structures, what I've called the institutionalized forms of greed, our economic system, where you never have enough, right? Our problematic institutionalization of ill will, not only our treatment of prisoners, but in particular our militarism, and our institutionalization of delusion, the media, which aren't really interested in educating and informing us, but rather their primary preoccupation is grabbing our attention so they can sell it to the highest bidder. In other words, advertising. In other words, they're really preoccupied with encouraging and rationalizing or naturalizing consumerism. We have to see these problems for what they are as institutionalized versions of the greed, ill will, delusion, the three poisons or three fires that the Buddha pointed to as the real roots of evil. And if we do that, in other words, ultimately I think we can see that the path of personal transformation, which is the way that we've been tending to understand Buddhism, and the path of social transformation, that these two paths, that these two reconstructions, that they need each other, that they're not separate from each other, and that we have to work on both. And I think this is a huge challenge for the Buddhist tradition, really. If we Buddhists can't do that or don't want to do that, then I think we really need to reflect, is Buddhism what the world needs right now, given the kind of challenges, the kind of crises that we're facing? Of course, I think that the Buddhist traditions have extraordinary potential to help us engage with the kind of crises we face. But if we're not willing to do that, then we need to find some other ways. We need to really reflect what it is within our tradition that can help. Anyway, I think that's enough for me for the time being. And thank you all for your attention.
Great. Well, thank you so much, David. That was a wonderful tour of the two icebergs, which I have heard before. I've heard some of this before, but always it's really a fantastic framing of the coming together and trying to steer this ship of our collective intention through this chilly waters. I'll stop with the metaphors because they're breaking down. So we're going to go into breakout sessions. So here's the inquiry that was inspired by David's talk. So how does the ecological crisis challenge my understanding and practice of Buddhism? So how does the ecological crises, how do they challenge my understanding and practice of this wisdom tradition? So with that, we'll go into a harvest session and invite those who would like to. We'll say, Andrew, go ahead. And you're on the public mic. And in the meantime, I'm going to unmute David.
Thank you, Kristen. And thank you so much, David. I was fortunate to be together in a great breakout session with Anna from Boston. And something that we thought was, in addition to these somewhat conceptual level impediments to Buddhists, becoming more socially engaged, cosmological dualism and individual salvation. There may be some good old baseline fear when, of waking up and saying, oh my God, look what's going on, not just to our environment, not just to our politics, not just to our economy, you know, to everything. And it takes a lot of courage to stand up and say in a crowd, the emperor is wearing no clothes. And hopefully this is something our practice can help us.
Well, I'm just trying to listen to.
Thank you, Andrew. Did you have a chance to finish that?
Yes, that's really all I wanted to share. Thank you.
Can I? I mean, I think that's so important, and I agree completely. And what I think that really highlights, I think, is the importance of community, the importance of Buddhist community. As I've often said, I think in American Buddhism we have a lot of Buddha's teachings. We have a lot of Dharma teachings, but I think what we don't really have sufficiently is the strong sense of community, and that's the kind of thing that's going to be necessary. You know, when we feel that we're mutually supporting each other, then it's a much easier way to overcome the fear that we naturally feel when we feel isolated and separate from other people. I think that's going to be absolutely essential in the future, both in terms of working together as the only way to address some of these really serious ecological challenges, but also and finding the courage that we need to do that. But also, given what that I think we, you know, we're going to be in for some hard times. I think that economically, ecologically, life could well be diminished, or the possibilities could be diminished in certain ways, and we may well find that the most important thing is for coping with that is not the bags of brown rice in your basement, but the fact that you're part of a loving, mutually supporting community of practitioners. So I mean, I just feel that this is naturally one of the ways that we're going to have to grow if it's going to work. Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you, Andrew. And so let's go. Let's see, Andrew, I think you muted yourself. Thank you. Let's go to Carol. Carol, you're on the public mic, and I've just prompted you to start your video. And so go ahead, Carol.
Okay, yes, this is me. Thanks, David, for what you just said about community, because as Joanne from Cape Town and I were talking, what we mostly talked about was the importance of being able to share these issues and work together with other people, because otherwise it becomes totally overwhelming and you begin to feel that you can't really make a difference. So I talked a bit with her about New York Buddhist Climate Action Network, which is a relatively small group of us, but we've joined with the global BCAN. And I think initiatives like that make a big difference. You know, so in addition to working on ourselves to become more functioning human beings and better able to participate in social engagement issues, that it's just critical to be doing it with other people, you know. So that's really all I have to say. Thanks.
Thank you, Carol.
Thank you, Carol. Just very briefly, you know, somehow we've got in our heads that Buddhist practice is individual. It's what's going on when I'm facing the wall or whatever. And it seems pretty clear we're going to have to expand our understanding of what practice is to include community, relating to other people. I think that has to be a more foundational part of the way we understand the Buddhist path. So thank you.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Carol. And let's go to Ada. Ada, you don't have a camera, it looks like, but you're on the public mic, so go ahead. Are you there, Ada? We don't have you. Maybe muted on your side. Okay, well, might have to come back to you later. We've only got time. Oh, it looks like we only have time for one more. So, oh, look at all these hands. Let's go to Mimi. Go ahead, Mimi, and if you will, go ahead and start your video. I think you'll get prompted to do that.
I can do that because I don't think my camera will. My camera shows my desktop. I don't know how to turn it around and make it a selfie.
Okay.
What I wanted, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I wanted to thank David for the feeling that he had of where our people, when you offered the teachings. We just did a couple of nights ago at our community meditation center, and there were seven of us, two of which were facilitators. But what we did was a personal, a spiritual, and that is a personal practical, a personal spiritual, and a public policy push action. And we're pledging to do this with buddies over 2 months to see if we can build that into a habit. I don't know what else to say except that I think that the poor are going to lead us, that comfort gets in our way as well as fear. That's it.
Yeah. Thank you, Mimi. Thank you. Good news.
Thank you, Mimi. Thank you. That's great. You know, I think I'll just add my own two cents here, which is to say, I think one of the things that we are challenged to do, I was speaking about this at a conference last week, is reclaim our inherent birthright, our inherent deep interconnectedness with Mother Earth, her bountiful generosity, and that is, instead of being now an impediment that I need to care about the earth, it's more a rejoining into deep relationship in this way, so that it ends up being good news, to say it briefly. I don't know if you want to say anything about that, David.
I would just be echoing what you said, Kristen. Thank you. I mean, I think that's so right. We think so often that we're sort of doing this on our own as whether it's individuals or as a group of people. But I mean, there's a sense in which the earth is flowing through us. We're manifestations of the earth. We are part of the way in which the earth is trying to heal itself. And we have to be open and appreciative of that. I mean, that's a big issue. There's a lot to talk about there, but I think that's essential. The same thing is with awakening. You know, it's like there's something deep in us that just wants us to let go and get out of the way so we can manifest. That's what's going on in the practice. And that's what's going on now as we ask, you know, what can be done to respond to that can help heal the earth. Anyway, too much for me. I'll shut up.
Yeah, it's like a whole other session.
That was lovely.
Yeah, another dimension there.
Thank you. Thank you, Mimi, for that. I think actually, we should close. So thank you, everybody. Sorry we didn't get to all of the hands, and thank you for participating in your breakout session. Thank you for engaging on this topic. You know, feel free, if you do have your hand up, or even if you don't, if you have questions, we invite you to email us at connect@wonersangha, and we'll pass those on to David and maybe do some commenting on the post with a little Q&A there. And you can also post your comments directly to the page that was advertising this session, and we can continue the conversation there. Okay, great. So with that, thank you again, David, and I'll turn it over to Lou, and we'll do some closing. We invite you to please stay with us just for a few more minutes because we want to tell you what's next, and then dedicate them there.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you, Kristen. Thank you, David. What a wonderful, provocative, intention setting kind of conversation to kick off the year. So again, just really grateful to have you, David, really kind of convene this space for us at the outset of the year. You know, and the theme that really came up to me as I was listening to the talk, but particularly in the sharing, you know, this concept of community, the power of it, not only to support ourselves, but to really unlock, you know, some of that, you know, different and more profound ways to, you know, to really connect to the truth of what is. And I think that, you know, that is a big part of the service that we're trying to provide here at One Earth Sangha. You know, it, you know, that there's so many, and I think in a really encouraging way, there's so many ways in which these, you know, these themes and this type of action is emerging within the broader mindfulness community, Buddhist community in the West and throughout the world. And One Earth Sangha is one of those, just one of those, but one of those. And, you know, as we look forward to the coming year, you know, coming out of a really beautiful manifestation of community through the Ecosattva training, you know, we're looking forward to a year where we really help provide more of these spaces to hear from teachers, but also to, you know, promote more of a conversation among the community, both about the, you know, the kind of grounding of these truths in our tradition and our practice, you know, but also, you know, as a way to promote more local interaction among folks and helping to connect people with each other and create ways to have local conversations. And that's one of the things that we've noticed coming out of the Ecosattva training is hearing more and more of these circles of people who took the training together and are staying together to engage with each other, support each other, go deeper on this path. So that's certainly one of the ways in which we see 2016 unfolding for us, is to provide more and more ways to support all of you and so many others that are coming together in ways that feel authentic and appropriate and actionable in your own lives. So I think that that's a big part of what we're looking forward to. We're going to convene more conversations like this with leaders like David. We're in conversation with others, and really a focus on supporting those local circles of folks who have come together either around the training, one of our trainings, or just themselves. You know, finding support in being able to practice together. And, you know, and another way in which we're able to act in community in our tradition is through the practice of dana. And one of the real fundamental necessities for us as a small, you know, a small team, you know, entering the second year with Kristen, really volunteering full time her life to One Earth Sangha. I think our ability to continue to do this is really dependent upon the community deciding that it's something that that wants to be, and that's part of the way folks are going to act in community is to support this work through the practice of dana. So encourage you to consider that, and you can go to the One Earth Sangha .org webpage and you can donate that way, and then continuing, you know, to the extent it feels right, to continue to donate your time and yourself to these conversations, I think is also what dana is about. And we're really grateful that you've already done that today by being here and making this a part of your weekend. So I'm going to hand it back over to Kristen to dedicate the merit and to bring us to a close, but just to say again, deep gratitude. This community is such an important part of my life and my path, and I just can't be more grateful for being able to be a part of this with you. So, Kristen.
Thank you so much, Lou. So, take a moment here to dedicate the merits to all beings. So, with all of us, we can come into our bodies. Perhaps give this wish. May all places be held sacred. May all beings be held in love. May all injustices of enslavement, oppression, any devaluation be righted, remedied, and healed. May all those chained by hatred be released to the boundless love that is their birthright. May all those bound by fear be released to the boundless safety of understanding. May all those weighed down by grief be released to the boundless joy of being. May all wounds to forests, rivers, deserts, oceans, all wounds to Mother Earth be lovingly restored to bountiful health. May all beings everywhere delight in birdsong and blue sky. May all beings open to peace and well-being, awaken and be free. Thank you so much for joining us, everyone. Have a beautiful, beautiful Sunday. May you be well. May you flourish.